Yes, we have no bananas. We have no bananas today.
Nipple skulls, hot skulls, spectacles, nipple skulls. Let's make this a blue evil.
Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way?
I'm Pete.
I'm Ben.
And welcome back to The Henson Perspective, where we talk about an episode of The Muppet Show, 45 years after its air date in 1978. This episode, we're talking about production episode 24, not actually production episode 24, which featured guest star Cheryl Ladd. It was produced between May 9th and 12th of 1978 at the very end of the production season of season 2, mm-hmm. and then it aired in New York City on November 6th, 1978. In his introduction, Kermit describes Cheryl Ladd as one of the loveliest and most talented ladies in the entire entertainment world.
Very high praise.
Very high praise. Pete, how did, if they did at all, TV Guide describe Cheryl Ladd?
You set this up to be a slam dunk. Oh, they must have done it. But now I'm thinking maybe you're double bluffing me and it's all a trap.
I'm just trying to better smooth into the section.
Yeah, I know. But I'm still going to say yes, because statistically speaking, I should say yes.
Unfortunately, there I was not able to find any Cheryl Ladd.
You, how dare you?
Any Cheryl Ladd entries in TV guides that were scanned into the internet. So I have no other St. Louis or Seattle or New York City or New Jersey or Salt Lake City information as to other alternate air dates for this episode.
Never been more upset in my life.
Sorry that you don't get an extra half point. But that is most of the extent of I know about Cheryl Ladd. I know that she was in Charlie's Angels, and I know that a poster of her was one of the best-selling poster images of all time.
Well, I don't know that, so that's news to me.
Yeah, like the tennis lady scratching herself in a sexy pose and Cheryl Ladd in a bathing suit in Charlie's Angels era were like some of the most wildly successful posters that were sold in the 70s and the 80s.
Interesting. Nope. No idea.
I'm now worried that the Charlie's Angels poster is Farrah Fawcett and not Cheryl Ladd.
Oh, almost. Yeah, hey. Probably. Also, potentially both.
Yeah.
There were definitely posters with her on it, too. Mm-hmm. Well, before we get to the trivia, I do want to just talk briefly about what you brought up earlier about the
production episodes.
It says on the fandom page that this was the last episode they shot before shooting the Muppet movie.
Mm-hmm.
So even though, yes, it's production episode 24, production episode 23, which is the Lynn Redgrave episode, has Muppets in it that are post-Muppet movie.
Yeah, the fandom points out that because when they filmed the Muppet movie, they rebuilt a number of the puppets, that after a break, they used those puppets in the filming of The Muppet Show for a while.
Yep.
So we're going to, apparently within the course of this season, start to see reconfigured Muppets on the show.
Yeah. So once again, we've talked about this before. I don't understand how you can film an episode basically, you know, 13th maybe, if that's where they broke, and then still call it 24 when you filmed the 23rd episode after this one.
Yeah.
I don't get it. I'll never get it.
The fandom page has zero explanation for why this is production episode 24. They also point out that it shouldn't be.
Mm-hmm.
And then they have no documentation for why it should be. They just acknowledge that it's listed as production episode 24. But they don't engage in any wild speculation. This makes me wonder, why do we even go to this website?
Because it's fairly well laid out, kind of.
In that same fandom page, they link to the Jim Henson's Red book website, which is on henson.com and details some of the diary entries that Jim made about various production information. There is a one-line entry in his book that says, yeah, we filmed with Cheryl Ladd today, and then they go through the episode to point out some of the interesting stuff about it. They use a production photo from this episode that features Ladd in a red outfit that appears nowhere on the show, posing with Sweetums, who appears nowhere on the show. But that must be a big disappointment to you.
I'm furious to find that out.
They also use an image from the production stills in this episode of Ladd posing with Miss Piggy in their karate outfits, which we'll get to, appeared on the cover of French Glamour magazine, I believe.
That makes sense.
It has an interesting cover blurb which says, Miss Piggy, shown alongside Cheryl Ladd, who is about to star in the Muppet movie, potentially winning Best Actress in 1980 Oscars.
All of that referring to Miss Piggy.
Yeah.
Okay.
But bizarre that they were going, no pun intended, whole hog on the idea that the Muppet movie's coming out. It's going to be so good that they might give a puppet Best Actress.
Played by a man.
Yes.
Wow.
It definitely has the potential to get somebody to read the magazine, which is what I suppose those cover blurbs are for.
Yeah, for sure. Well, now that we talked about that, now let's dive into the trivia. So, Ben, I have 5 questions for you. Let's start with question number 1.
That's usually the order in which these things go.
Yeah, not always.
Ooh.
But this time, yes. Question 1. Cheryl is probably best known as replacing Farrah Fawcett Majors in the TV series Charlie's Angels. But in which season did Cheryl Ladd join the show? Was it A, season 2, B, season 3, or C, season 4?
A.
That is correct. Farrah Fawcett Majors left after only the first season. And despite only being in 29 episodes total to Cheryl Ladd's 87 episodes,
she's still more associated with the show.
Yeah. And I read a lot of quotes in my research that Cheryl Ladd said she was given a hard time by the cast and crew for joining mid-series, even though it wasn't her fault that Farrah Fawcett Majors left. People still took it out on her. Hmm. Question number 2. Before Cheryl was a member of Charlie's Angels, she got her start as the singing voice of a character on what Saturday morning cartoon show? A. Jem. B. Josie and the Pussycats. C. Schoolhouse Rock.
I don't think Jem predates Charlie's Angels, so I'm going to go with Josie and the Pussycats.
That is also correct. I was hoping you didn't have that knowledge, but in Googling cartoon musicals, there weren't a lot pre-1980. It was just Josie and the Pussycats, Schoolhouse Rock, or The Beatles, and I was like, he's not going to buy that one. But yes, Cheryl Ladd was the singing voice of Melody in Josie and the Pussycats. She was credited as Cherie Moore, as her birth name was Cheryl Jean Stoppelmore. Ladd was her first husband's name, which she kept after the divorce in 1980, and before she married Cousin Brian Russell in 1981.
Aw, lucky Cousin Brian.
Question number 3. In 2000, Cheryl Ladd took over the titular role in the revival of Irving Berlin's Annie Get Your Gun on Broadway from what past Muppet Show guest host? A. Bernadette Peters. B. Ethel Merman. Or C. Sandy Duncan.
C.
Incorrect. You fell for my trap of I always throw Sandy Duncan in there. Whenever I see your name, she's an answer. It was Bernadette Peters. Ethel Merman originated the role.
Yes.
And was had been dead for 16 years when Cheryl Ladd took the role in 2000. Cheryl Ladd was Annie from September 2000 to January 2001 when Reba McEntire took over for her. Question 4. On what Pete beloved TV show did Cheryl Ladd play one of the main characters' mothers? A. Boy Meets World. B. News Radio. C. Two Guys, a Girl, and a Pizza Place.
C.
That is correct. She plays Ryan Reynolds' character's Bird's mom.
I have no memory of that.
two episodes. But I saw it and went, that's going in.
Yep. That is a perfect reference.
I was originally going to do other shows that started in 1998, but the only other one that was Pete Beloved was Sports Night, and I knew you'd know that wasn't the answer. Even me throwing News Radio in, I was like, he's not going to fall for that trap. But question five. Sometimes I like to give Ben a taste of his own medicine. So it's time for another round of 6 degrees of Jim Henson.
Nice.
Ben, I'm going to give you Cheryl Ladd's top four projects at IMDb.
Okay.
You'll have 60 seconds to connect Cheryl Ladd to Jim Henson using anyone from any of the projects that I'm about to give you. Cheryl Ladd's top four on IMDb are Poison Ivy, starring Drew Barrymore, Sarah Gilbert, Tom Skerritt, and Leonardo DiCaprio. Millennium, from 1989, starring Kris Kristofferson, Daniel J. Travanti, Robert Joy. Charlie's Angels, which is a TV show, so it doesn't count. And 2017's Unforgettable, starring Rosario Dawson, Katherine Heigl, Sarah Burns, or Whitney Cummings. Using any of those people, or anyone else in any of those projects, your time begins now.
Yeah, I'm gonna lose this. Rosario Dawson is in... Rosario Dawson is in Shattered Glass with Hayden Christensen, who is in Star Wars Episode II with The Phantom Menace, Attack of the Clones with Frank Oz's voice of Yoda, who is in the Muppet movie with Jim Henson.
30 seconds. I hate you. The fastest I was able to come up with, and most obscure probably, was that Katherine Heigl was in My Father the Hero with Stephen Tobolowsky, who's in Groundhog Day with Andy McDowell, who's in Muppets in Space with any of the puppeteers.
Who are in the Muppet movie with Jim Henson.
Yeah.
That's good. I obviously immediately thought of My Father the Hero.
Oh, really?
Because that's like one of the few Katherine Heigl things. I've never seen the movie, so I don't know anybody else who's in it except Gerard Depardieu. And I was like, that is a terrible dead end. I can't remember who's in La Retour de Martinguerre.
Another avenue that I know there's a way from, but my brain couldn't tell me, is through Tom Skerritt, because he's in Space Camp with Leah Thompson.
Ah.
And then I was like, I know I've tried to do Leah Thompson. You've corrected me on that before. My brain won't retain that information, though.
I also feel like both Drew Barrymore and Leo DiCaprio are, like, wildly connectable people.
Yeah, but I similarly was it was too big.
Uh-huh. And I stalled out. But I feel like Scream, I feel like Charlie's Angels, these are things that should be good avenues. Speaking of Charlie's Angels, Drew Barrymore's in Charlie's Angels with Crispin Glover, who's in Back to the Future with Leah Thompson. So we get right back to the same problem.
Another fun fact?
Yeah.
So you said one of my two final fun facts that, yes, Poison Ivy starred Drew Barrymore, who went on to be in Charlie's Angels, and Unforgettable starred Rosario Dawson, who was in the Josie and the Pussycats movie.
Oh!
So in two of her four, there's connections to previous Pat projects.
That's fun.
But yeah, otherwise, mostly what Cheryl Ladd has been up to is TV movies.
Okay.
So there wasn't a lot that I could pull from for trivia from that. Like, how many Danielle Steele movies has she been in? The answer is three. But I didn't feel like that was necessarily a fair question to throw in there. Or necessarily entertaining other than the joke of it.
Mm.
So, yeah, she's constantly working still. But Charlie's Angels is truly her peak. She basically just works off of that. So this was 78, so this would have been shortly after she joined the cast.
Okay. So I felt like there was interesting subtext, and the reason why I had leapt to the idea that she was the person in the poster and not one of the other cast of Charlie's Angels is I feel like there is a running aspect to the show that is referring to without specifically doing so, by alluding to her sex appeal. That in the opening segment, we have Scooter saying,
I just can't seem to get my costume off. off. You're supposed to put it on. Mm-hmm.
Therefore, creating in the audience the image of Cheryl Ladd taking her clothes off. Then, in her second number, she goes behind a screen and takes off her clothes. And then in the final number, it's very pastel, it's very homely, it's not playing into that regard at all. And in fact, none of her outfits are particularly sexy or sensual. But at the same time, there is this low-level sense of them trying to create in the audience the vibe of the expectation of, we all know that you're hot for Cheryl Ladd. And I found that to be kind of bizarre, that The Muppet Show felt like it was trying to have its cake and eat it too in that way. That they were never showing you anything that was less than family friendly, but they were also hinting at the idea that that's why you would be interested in her as a performer.
Yeah, I mean, you're probably right in why you confused her and Farrah Fawcett, because that's, she was replacing one of the sexiest women of all time in all of America's eyes. So they probably had to be like, well, we got to have another one. So let's just keep trying to build her to be like, yeah, no, it makes sense that she's Farrah Fawcett now.
But it feels weird for the Muppets to be, and maybe that's me having fallen victim to that hype of, she's the new sexy blonde on Charlie's Angels, and I'm just therefore assuming that that's how people thought about her.
Yeah,
but it is therefore a possibility that I'm projecting that sex appeal awareness onto the writing of the Muppets, except that they have two different jokes that refer to her being unclothed.
No, I don't think you're reading into anything. Okay. I think it's definitely out on Front Street.
Fair enough.
No, Farrah Fawcett left the show. This is Cheryl Ladd.
Fair enough, Majors.
Well, I mean, we've basically already talked about the cold open, because the simple joke is, as you said, Scooter tells her 20 seconds to curtain. She can't get her costume off. He tells her she needs to put it on, not take it off. And there's a monster next to her wearing her costume.
Pete?
Yep.
Is the monster wearing her costume?
He's wearing a dress, it looks like.
So you've got the photo in front of you.
Yes.
What is the lunch counter monster wearing in that?
It is a, like, spider web-esque sweater. It's black with white lines going up and down, making like a checkerboard pattern.
So, when we eventually get to her first musical number, you'll see that she's wearing white pants and a white blousey shirt and a black vest with a diamond white striped pattern on it. And it looks like they used the rest of the roll of fabric to drape around the lunch counter monster.
Yep, for sure.
So, on the one hand, they have successfully established continuity of he is wearing, quote, her costume, unquote. But on the other hand, the amount of fabric in there is so wildly not in keeping with what she was wearing.
In the approximately 5 minutes between this segment and that song, they ran it through a dryer, like an industrial dryer, to shrink that fabric back.
They had all of the giant monsters that work on doing the dress setting being seamstresses in order to get that to more closely fit Cheryl.
Yep. They cut to curtain, Ben?
At?
20 seconds.
Well done, Muppets.
Yep. Good job. We go to the opening, where Statler and Waldorf. My episode, I get a Statler and Waldorf.
So, I took a brief look at the previous episodes that have had Statler and Waldorf on it, and it's been production episode 3, production episode 6, and production episode 13. So it's not even numbers or odd numbers. There is seemingly no pattern. And also, before I knew that this was secretly production episode 12, but pretend episode 24, I was like, well, that doesn't follow any pattern anyway. I've, in fact, made a bunch of assumptions about the fact that this was the last episode of the season that are no longer going to hold up in my notes.
Yeah. Statler says, hey, would you guys be quiet? We're trying to heckle up here. Good joke.
Perfectly fine joke. And when Gonzo comes out, when he blows into the trumpet, it sounds like an alarm clock.
Solid. But I'm not surprised they haven't done it yet.
Not distinct. Like, I wanted a good, clear bell. This was a bad recording of an alarm clock.
Yeah, but, you know, 1978, you know, an alarm clock goes off, you have a little tape recorder next to it. Talkboy technology wasn't really quite there yet.
We go to the curtain, Kermit uses the language that I said earlier about her being
one of the loveliest and most talented ladies of the entire entertainment world.
Which, considering that this was the high point of her entertainment career, what had been building up to this? Anything in particular?
Not really.
So she sort of came out of the blue.
Yeah, so Josie and the Pussycats was 1970.
But also this not is, her same name.
Yeah, and this is 78. So not a ton of time, and she doesn't have a ton of credits in between that and this.
So this is wild overstatement of her career. She may be on the most successful show on network television at the moment, but it's not down to her, and she hasn't been necessarily a rising star that people have been looking out for.
Yeah, she has a bunch of single episode TV work. Police Woman, Police Story, one episode of Happy Days, The Partridge Family for one episode of Ironside, The Ken Berry Wow Show.
Of course, The Ken Berry Wow Show. It is makes and breaks careers.
And then some music videos, and then 87 episodes of Charlie's Angels.
Well, I mean, that is how careers got made in those days. You popped hard on episodes of Police Woman and The Love Boat, and people were like, get this person a series because they've got star power.
There was an anecdote on her Wikipedia page about she auditioned for a role that she didn't get for Aaron Spelling, who was one of the executive producers of Charlie's Angels.
Right.
She got on his radar from that audition that he didn't give her the part. But then when this happened, he was like, oh, she'd be good for this.
But the mention of Ladd and her career accolades, however fictional they may be, is not really the focus of this introduction by Kermit. He spends twice as much real estate setting up the first musical number because it seems like they need to work hard in order to instill the audience's expectations of this comic premise. And in that regard, Miss Piggy and Link Hogthrob are doing a jungle number, he emphasizes.
Steamy jungle number.
Steamy jungle number. And we cut to a jungle set that has many of the birds from the pilot's episode of Sex and Violence. Plus, we have palm fronds, ferns, flowers, a thatched grass and bamboo hut. And Piggy in a leopard skin off-the-shoulder dress with a fang-tooth necklace. And then black sequined high-heeled shoes, fishnet stockings, and her traditional long silk gloves.
Singing a ballad.
The ballad is called True Love. It's from the film High Society, which came out in 1956. We've mentioned High Society before because there's a number in that.
Is that in the Ethel Merman?
It's not in that medley. Okay. It's in the Rich Little medley where he's doing various impressions. And he and Kermit do a duet that is the song between Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra that they put in High Society. So this is the only other High Society soundtrack that shows up, to my knowledge, in The Muppet Show. I say that, and it will be in At the Dance next week.
Yes!
This song, they feel, is romantic, but needs punch-up to be entertaining. And they do
they are right.
Different kinds of punch-up. The first punch-up is that they have Link swinging on a vine as a Tarzan sort of thing. And he crashes into a stone wall and comes up behind a famous jungle flora and evergreen tree. That he struggles to sing behind. And then they ramp up the tempo in order to introduce the last verse by having a chimpanzee, birds, a crocodile, and a random hunter who's coming back in from Hush Children, What's That Sound?
I counted one hit and one fall in this. Because Link hits the rock wall and then falls from it.
I don't think previous Pete would have counted that as a hit. I think you're getting desperate for statistics.
Yeah, I'm counting it. Yeah, if it wasn't for the animals and it picking up steam, probably would have marked this as a barn.
Yeah, it's definitely weird. They throw in one last joke of the animals during the final chorus all starting to make loud animal jungle sounds, so much so that Piggy yells at them to knock it off and they quiet down momentarily. But it's very clear that they know this doesn't stand alone as a song, and so they're just throwing stuff at the wall, and it only sort of works. I feel like the direction also can't commit to this is a funny song or this is a good song.
Well, good song is debatable.
For example, like Octopus's Garden,
yeah,
where the vibe and the performance is one, and then during the musical interlude, they throw in a bunch of jokes, but they're playing the song straight.
Yeah.
This is playing the song straight for half a verse, and then it's jokes, jokes, jokes. Because they're pretty convinced that this is going to die as an opening number on its musical merits.
Yeah.
Is my interpretation of what I saw.
And I agree with it. Statler and Waldorf also have something to say.
Waldorf says, "Me, Waldorf, you, Statler."
And Statler corrects him and says, "No, you, Waldorf, me, sick."
Yeah, I didn't really get this. I get that it's a Tarzan reference.
Yeah.
But what on earth is Statler's objection to Waldorf's dumb joke?
He's correcting him because that last sketch made him sick.
So he's not Statler.
He's sick. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, it's, "I'm hungry. Hi, hungry. I'm Pete."
Okay, that's certainly better than what I worried it was, which was if Waldorf saying, "Me, Tarzan, you, Jane," that Statler's being like, "No, I'm not going to be your Jane, you weirdo."
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. I think it was a reaction to the last segment. We go backstage where Kermit is standing next to the Beethoven bust as Piggy comes off stage with some animals.
Kermit compliments Piggy on her performance, then the chimpanzee, and then Link swings by on the vine and crashes off stage, creating the fairly decent joke because Kermit has said, "Nice singing, Piggy. Nice singing, Chimp." And then, "Nice swinging, Link."
Quality joke. Kermit then calls for Ralph to get on stage.
Which means we have the weird lineup of Link, and then Kermit, and then Ralph doing lines in quick succession. So we have three Jim puppets all doing things. The Tarzan-esque yell by Link doesn't really sound like Jim. So it's either Jim on a recording or it's somebody doing a stand-in.
Mm-hmm. Ralph enters, says it'll be great. Now, Ben?
Yes?
I have some statistics on this.
Please.
He leaves for the stage at 4 minutes and 38 seconds into the episode. Beethoven makes some comments about Ralph's playing ability. At 4 minutes and 43 seconds, the captions say there's piano playing.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. At 5 minutes and 17 seconds, you can hear some faint applause for the song ending.
Correct.
And then Fozzie leaves as Rolf re-enters at 5 minutes and 21 seconds.
Yes.
So the song that Rolf played was 34 seconds long. Or, not only is the Muppet Theater a Real House of Leaves situation, but time also works differently there because Rolf usually plays at least three times as long in his UK spot segment.
Yeah, it's literally a quarter of a UK spot if it's 34 seconds long. So this is not just a hassle-y situation. This is some wibbly-wobbly, timey-wimey stuff.
Uh-huh. But going back to the content of this segment, mm-hmm. Beethoven talks about how Ralph regularly plays fortissimo.
Yes.
And when he re-enters, Ralph acknowledges that he played fortissimo.
Which means?
I assume fast?
It means loud.
Oh, okay. Well,
I had a feeling that you wouldn't know what that was, so I was going to quiz you on it anyway, but I like that you
I assume... fell into your own trap that you did not even bother to set up. I just went, "Oh, is this a trap?" Ugh.
No, it doesn't mean that he was playing the minute waltz so fast that it was only 34 seconds long. Although, yeah, if they had done "He plays it allegro," that would have been the perfect way to do it.
Hey, 45 years, we'll punch anything up.
Including plot holes. Before we move on.
Yes.
Could you not hear the piano offstage?
Very faintly.
Okay. I could hear it fairly clearly.
It says, "I should ask my boss," that's you, "to make a list of my good points and my bad points."
Oh, Fozzie, you don't want me to do that.
Okay.
So, I'm just checking to make sure you did count it in your music time.
I did not.
You need to.
Well, good thing I did all this time. Well, while Ralph is on stage for 34 seconds, Fozzie enters and asks Kermit to make a list of his good points and bad points to help him with an exercise in a self-improvement book he's reading. Kermit doesn't want to, because he knows it's not going to go well, because it's Fozzie. But after some pressure...
Particularly because Fozzie is emphasizing that he wants Kermit to be honest about this.
Like, brutally honest.
In order to reinforce that he wants Kermit to say the truth about his strengths and weaknesses.
And then Kermit looks directly to camera and says, how can you gently run someone over with a truck?
Just a great line.
And then he just walks on stage to deliver the introduction for the next act.
He had told Fozzie when Fozzie came and said, are you busy with anything? He says, I have to introduce Cheryl Ladd. So he doesn't have that much time to dwell on the fact that he is about to emotionally eviscerate his good friend and scene partner. That is a problem for next sketch.
Yeah. So yes, Kermit introduces Cheryl Ladd. It is another standard, no-frills introduction, pretty much.
Well, he does say that while she's known for her dazzling performances on television, that's only one of the things that she does well, and now you can see for yourself all the things that she can do here.
Mm.
And so we do, in fact, get a song that highlights her charm, but also that she's a reasonably good dancer. If you didn't know that she was the voice of one of Josie's Pussycats, that she can sing fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
Her lip-syncing abilities are moderate at best, but she is also singing along to a track while dancing.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a raised platform with the Clodhoppers coming out. We haven't seen the Clodhoppers since Valerie Harper danced with them back in the first season, where they did Nobody Does It Like Me, and the whole joke was that these over-large Grover-like things were wearing shoes that they stepped on her feet while they were all dancing together. The fact that they have shoes and are dancing is not really the focus of this. It's that they're playing instruments, that they're doing kind of a New Orleans jazz
Tremé band thing. I loved this.
Mm.
I've never seen Chicago, but I imagine that the outfit Cheryl is wearing is Chicago-esque, except a little less burlesque. But it still struck me as something that I've seen on the cover of that DVD case.
A small white bowler hat and a black ribbon tie. It's a great outfit.
Mm-hmm. It's a great performance. Super energetic, really good choreography.
She's dancing with Timmy Monster.
Mm-hmm.
Timmy Monster is played by, we've talked about before, a variety of different Muppeteers. I'm not sure any of them is in Timmy Monster this time round. I suspect it's a professional dancer that they sometimes use. There is a moment where Timmy Monster almost steps on his own tail and nearly dies, and then they cut away from it. So it either happened and they couldn't use it, or they avoided it and were just lucky. The song, on the other hand, which is called The South Rampart Street Parade, has almost no profile. Like, it's not from Chicago. It's not from a musical. It is a jazz song that didn't originally have lyrics when it was written in 1937. There were recordings that added lyrics onto it. In 1953, there was a Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters performance, which has the same kind of peppy quality to it that they have here. There was a 1973 performance of the recording with lyrics, where it was sung by Teresa Brewer.
Oh.
So there is the possibility that this had come across the music directors of the Muppets while they were working with her, or it could just be from the Southern jazz that the Hensons listened to while they were doing their own stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I have zero evidence either way as to what the source of this would be. But it is interesting that almost all of the music in this episode seems to come from the 50s. High Society was 1956.
Mm-hmm.
The Bing Crosby performance of this was 1953. Later, we'll have That's a New Sound in the UK spot, which is from 1953 and was performed on Sam and Friends in 1958. Then we'll have a song from the Rodger and Hammerstein musical Flower Drum Song, which is also 1958.
Wow.
With the exception of the final song that Cheryl Ladd will do, which is from 1971 or 1973, the same year that Teresa Brewer did this number, like, there's a weird consistency as to where the music falls.
Huh.
But it's not a well-known song, and while this performance is technically good, the lyrics are not especially interesting, except for the fact that they're singing about let's dance. Mm-hmm. Dancing and rhythm is fun.
I really get a thrill. I know I always will. Whenever I can hear the rhythm of a band.
But it's not clever or catchy in terms of, like, you leave the song with the lyrics stuck in your head.
Oh, for sure, yeah.
It's very bland in that regard.
No, Beauregard is the new janitor.
Who will weirdly show up in the last song. Yeah.
And I'll be mad about it then, too.
I just thought it was odd how good this is, mm-hmm. with also not being particularly memorable or effective, except as a vehicle to show us that Cheryl Ladd can do more things. But even that, they didn't pick a song that I think anybody cared about, which is odd.
Yeah. But they got to have yet another trumpet player, Ben.
Oh, yeah. One of the big Grovers is playing a trumpet. And according to our next sketch, playing it off-key.
Yeah.
So that's another reason why you might want to keep cycling through those trumpet players.
Or
a new one per episode.
Use the one you've got.
That's right.
That is good, but apparently not good enough to use in anything other than that one song every episode.
Good enough to play with the band and to make them sound good, but apparently not good enough to be up on stage.
Maybe she only knows the theme song.
She did play with the band when they were going to walk out, and they were like, we're not going to play your stuff. I don't suspect that was because she only knows one song. She then, I think, plays the theme song in the new weird jazz version that Floyd writes.
Mm.
Of course, the weird jazz version that Floyd writes was terrible. So maybe she covered up for the fact that she only knows that one song by sounding awful in that version.
We don't get a Statlin Waldorf comment.
Nope, it goes straight back to backstage from there.
Which I was surprised by. Kermit tells Pigs in Space that they're up next, and it just dawned on me with this episode, Ben.
Yeah.
Because they just started doing this fairly recently, the Kermit calling what's up next.
Mm-hmm.
It's a really smart way to convince people to not change the dial.
Huh, because they're anticipating what's about to happen.
Yeah, if they say, ooh, I like Vets Hospital. Vets Hospital is on next. I'll stick around through this one.
It's weird that the previous instance of him using the intercom was to set up an act that very definitely performed on stage that we didn't see.
Mm-hmm. But we did hear, according to you.
Yep. It was real, but that the show of the show was not that performance. Now we have a segment where previously we had three gyms in a row. Mm-hmm. Now we have the cast of Pigs in Space walk out on stage eerily silent and short, as if not to be paid attention to, because who knows who's playing them. Who is Beethoven in this episode? I'm assuming Jerry?
Unless... Oh, yes, the bust of Beethoven. There he is. Yep.
Because there's a decent amount of three-handers in this between Frank and Jerry and Jim, which matches our previous conversations about Jerry feeling unappreciated,
mm-hmm.
that he's playing the characters that are, they aren't the recurring characters on the show. He's playing the color that helps the main characters interact.
Yeah, for example, in this episode's listing, the reason it took me so long to find that is because the first character that Jerry is listed as playing is Quango.
Yes.
And I was like, who's Quango? Is that the bust of Beethoven's real name?
Is it the chimp?
Oh, probably. It's not a clickable name anywhere else in this article. It just says Jerry Nelson as Quango.
When the chimp started doing its bit, I was like, oh, that's Jerry. Like,
yeah.
It had that great vibe, that great performance vibe that he regularly brings to the show.
Yeah.
And here, he sets up the sequence, but then Fozzie comes in and blows him over.
Now, Ben, I have more stats.
Okay.
So Fozzie asked Kermit to write this list at the end of the last segment.
Yes.
But when Fozzie re-enters after Beethoven complains about the trumpet player, agreeing with you, it's only been 3 minutes and 47 seconds since he asked him to write it. And he's saying, hey, you got that list done? Very needy, Fozzie.
Yeah. The weird thing about this is this runner dies here.
Yeah.
So it feels like there's some weird writing-ness going on, that this was supposed to be a thing that continued to happen, and they abandoned it.
Mm-hmm.
So then the runner becomes what happens to Gonzo.
Yep.
This episode has structural problems that feel like they were squishing two things together, and they were just like, okay, well, we're not going to end that. It's just going to be a dangling thread. We're never going to come back to it. Because Fozzie's reaction is enough. We're not going to do it as a three-act structure.
Fozzie, I think I better explain.
No, Kermit, it's okay. It's okay. I can understand how you might think that I have these bad points.
Oh, well, actually, that list is your good points.
And the late placement of Gonzo, instead of, like, catching the cannonball and having his arm come out and then that being a runner throughout the show, Gonzo's later squishing by the 5,000-pound weight shows up twice after that and is then the final moment of the show, basically.
Yeah, it's weird. And I definitely noticed that when I was like, wait, they never went back to that.
Yeah, but it does feel like there should be an escalation.
What I would have liked to see is not another backstage segment.
Yeah.
But I would have liked to see him, a Fozzie
comedy moment
where Statler and Waldorf heckle him and he reacts positively to him.
Mm-hmm.
Of being like, yes, I'm growing, or keeps taking it and taking it and taking it, acting
normal, can't anymore.
And then exploding. Yeah.
The self-improvement, not as a backstage segment, but as an aspect to Fozzie doing stand-up, also feels like a logical extension of what's going on here.
Mm-hmm. But nope, instead, as we've talked about, Kermit tells them they're actually good things. Fozzie looks directly at camera and drops the clipboard in dismay as Pigs in Space happens with, yet again, no intro.
Well, we do have the, quote, joke, unquote, of the Swine Trek flying backwards.
Yeah.
But yes, third season Muppet Show now is just Pigs in Space with a shot of the Swine Trek and then directly to voiceover and the pan in through the window. That is going to remain consistent. We're no longer going to have the heads in the darkness.
Can't wait for 3 weeks from now having heads in the darkness.
I'm convinced I've done my research properly this time. I could be wrong.
Well, it'll be fine because I won't remember that you said it until you bring it up.
Fair point. Majors. But it feels like what the setup is going to be is, when last we left our heroes, their motivator drive was stuck in reverse and the Swine Trek was trailing backwards into a nebula. But no, it has nothing to do with the backwards motion of the Swine Trek. That's just a random gag that is disconnected to anything else.
Yep.
Instead, Strange Fork has come up with a pill that would make pigs invisible.
Before Piggy enters, Link and Strange Fork take it. So that way they disappear before she can find them, so they can play some pranks on her.
They're the Richard Kind and George Clooney of outer space.
Always pranking their roommates. Piggy takes advantage of being alone, quote-unquote, to use the intercom, but as she's using it, the microphone moves away and then hits her.
I'd like to point out that in season two, the intercom was a payphone.
True.
But they seem to have upgraded the apparatus somewhat, that now the intercom is just a mic on a stick.
Piggy recognizes the hit, which isn't a good sign. Like, you should never be able to be like, oh, that person hit me. I know.
There's a thing that people used to say about telegraph operators. You could tell who somebody was by the timing of their Morse code. And what that was referred to is you knew their fist.
Mm.
You should never know someone's fist by the way in which they punch you.
And also, it's weird that it's Strange Pork. Mm-hmm. That I was not expecting. That was a subversion of Strange Pork being the one who hit her, not Link.
I don't know if that's true. She says, I know that fist, and Strange Pork is the first person to reappear, but he's still further away from her than Link would be, so it makes sense that Link would have been the person that hit her.
Yeah, I think it's the way I wrote my notes that misled me to believe
that. I understand that conclusion, that because he's the first to pop up.
What the hey? I know that hit! Strange
But I think spatially, not knowing where they actually are because they're invisible, it makes more sense that Link is the primary prankster going on here.
But because they've reappeared, Piggy decides to take her revenge on them by going full-on Hollow Man. And grabbing the remaining pill to disappear herself, and then just starts leveling Link and Strange Bork for... We're now up to 5 hits this episode by the end of this sketch.
Yeah, the third one really sneaks in right under the wire.
Yeah. We fade to black on Pigs in Space, and we fade up on Cheryl Ladd in her dressing room.
Well, no. We fade down on Pigs in Space and fade up on the UK spot.
Huh?
Oh, interesting.
There's no UK spot. It goes from Pigs in Space to dressing room.
On Disney Plus.
Had to pop in that DVD to watch this UK spot.
Well, that strikes me as one of the decisions that you might most have regretted in your entire life, because this UK spot is insanely bad.
Oh, what are you talking about? It's great. I loved it. It's all about worms.
Okay. So, mentioned...
Is it the same 14 seconds repeated for approximately 2 minutes? Yes.
There's a new sound. It's deep down in the ground. And everyone who listens to it squirms because it's new sound. So deep down in the ground is the sound that's made by worms.
The song is called There's a New Sound by Tony Barella, which I previously mentioned came out in 1953 and was covered on Sam and Friends in 58. There's an anecdote on the Muppet Wikia about when they covered it on Sam and Friends. Mm. Jim Henson, on the liner notes to one of the Muppet CDs, says that this song was so bad that when they played it on Sam and Friends, they sort of did it as a test because they assumed that people would complain about it.
Huh.
Because it was so awful. And they got no mail and no phone calls, which convinced them that no one was watching the show. And yet, they did it again on The Muppet Show 20 years later. As you mentioned, the song is the same verse repeated 4 times. One of the reasons why Henson says it's so bad is that he says it's the same note repeated over and over again. There are no chord changes.
Mm.
And the only thing that happens in each verse, it goes up a key.
Mm-hmm.
The original version of this appeared on something called Horrible Records, which on the record label of the 7-inch single release on this has the motto, if it's really a horrible record, it's bound to be a hit.
Is the B-side on that record the song that will never end?
No. It's a song called Fish, and the note on that was it was recorded in the Holland Tunnel. Whereas this, it claims, was recorded 3,400 feet below sea level. And it says that the vocal, is recorded with monotone calliope. This is the only record that Horrible Records put out.
Huh.
When you look up Horrible Records on Wikipedia, it just redirects you to the song, because that's the only thing that they ever put out. They printed 500 of them to send to radio stations, and it was so successful, they sold 10,000.
Wow.
But here's my favorite thing about listening to the original 7-inch recording of this. Pete?
Yeah?
There's a fifth verse.
Oh, hell yeah.
And it's just the same verse going up one more key. The original version is just that extra 17 seconds long.
Ben, I have a new quiz for you.
Okay.
There are 2 different color vinyls available on Discogs for this single.
Okay.
There is a
standard black and a
red vinyl.
Okay.
The red vinyl has a higher high selling point than the black. What is the highest amount this record has sold for on Discogs? None are currently available for sale. And yes, I've added both to my want list on Discogs.
You're an insane human being. I feel like, based on everything I just said, the temptation is to lowball it. But considering that it does have a cult presence, it could also be wildly expensive. So if my lowball answer would be $7, but my wild above answer is $220. And now I'm going to flip a coin to see whether I go high ball or low ball. That's heads.
That is heads.
Then it's low ball.
So your final answer is?
$7.
The standard black vinyl has sold at a high of $29.99.
Okay.
Median, $24.25. That reason why I've added it, all three versions. I found a third version since then, which high is $55.48.
Mm.
The red vinyl is $49.99. Lows of anywhere between 10 and 15. Median's all in the mid-20s. Hey, if I can find one for that price, I like that song enough to buy it.
You're an insane human being. This might be the worst song the Muppets have performed.
Absolutely not. Can I tell you what it is? No, because I don't remember. All I know is I loved this. I took a video recording of it and sent it to Zach. He has a theory about worms. So once it was about worms, I was like, oh, right. I gotta do this.
All right. Yeah. Insane that this song was a minor cult hit. Insane that Henson did it as a litmus test to prove that nobody listened to Sam and Friends, and yet then did it again 20 years later. Insane that 45 years after that, you think it's good.
All I'll say is Zach's one-word response back after watching it was, banger. I'm so happy I bought this DVD, and because I was like, oh, it's a song. I have to have it for the timing.
Good point. I forgot about that aspect.
Great.
Hot garbage.
Loved it.
Then we go to the dressing room with Cheryl, where she's putting on perfume when Piggy enters. And Cheryl says, I'm sorry, you know, I hope you don't mind that I borrowed some of your perfume. And Piggy has the great moment of sniffing the perfume and then saying, oh yeah, that stuff's okay for you to borrow.
Very good joke. It's not her good stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great.
And the classic Frank thing of, like, Piggy has three registers. She has her I'm hyper femme register, she has her I'm gonna kill you bosso register, and she has her
laissez-faire,
yeah, ridiculous alto register. And for her to go into the,
oh, Miss Piggy, come in.
Ah, thank you.
Oh, by the way, I borrowed some of your perfume. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, that stuff's okay.
Is exactly the right performance on Frank's part.
Cheryl reveals she's a big fan of Piggy, which Piggy always loves hearing.
She's about to ask Cheryl what she likes about her and then decides, no, she wants to guess so that she can list off all the things she loves about herself. She says her eyes, her blonde hair, her sylph-like figure. But no, Cheryl likes her chops.
Which Piggy initially takes offense to, as she should, because she's so used to pig slander around the show.
It is interesting that they don't underline chops equals pork chops.
Yeah.
Equals,
it's kind of swallowed.
Yeah. But they don't take the opportunity to make the pig slander themselves.
Yeah.
Which normally they would do.
Yeah, but I appreciated it, of making it be a Homer joke of, you know, on the way home, like, oh yeah, that's good. But Cheryl does clarify, no, the karate chops.
After that, they go back and forth a little bit about having seen each other in action. Piggy said, reveals that she's a fan of her role on Charlie's Angels. They talk about the fact that you would need to defend yourself as a woman. And then Piggy says, ready? And Cheryl says, ready. Which reveals to me that none of this is genuine. This is all sketch preamble. And that this was a prepared bit.
But it's backstage.
I know. But why would they be checking in with each other as,
oh,
we've done enough banter, now we can go into our musical number? That's what it makes it sound like, that they're now prepared to move on to the next bit of their performance.
Do they do the ready part there, or do
they do it both?
When they grab when Cheryl grabs her,
yep,
dummy? Huh. Because,
yeah,
that one
later,
made sense to me.
Once they've changed and they've done the intro to the song, then Cheryl has the dummy, and Piggy says, hang on, let me get my dummy, and summons in Kermit.
I have a dummy too. Kermit!
Yeah, what do you want?
Never mind, sweetie, just trust me.
Yeah?
Ready?
Right.
And then they get back to the song.
Mm.
So again, this is a prepared bit that the audience wouldn't be seeing because it's backstage. And they just faked their way through their dialogue. Which makes sense, because that was some of the weirdest atmosphere during... I couldn't figure out from the direction or from the acting on the part of the performers whether or not this was going to turn into a fight or a love fest. They were both acting as if they were nervous that it could go either way at any time.
I have an idea.
Yeah.
This was them rehearsing for something they would then do on stage.
Huh.
So it's all genuine, but Piggy enters knowing that they're going to practice. So that's them acknowledging, like, okay, are you ready to now practice?
And that because we don't always see what's on stage, it could have been done as an act on stage at some point in the show, but we as the television audience didn't see it.
Yeah.
It's not a bad headcanon.
We do know that they do rehearse with the guest stars sometimes.
I don't think the dialogue completely lends itself to that.
100% not.
But it's an interesting attempt at justifying it.
I'll take it.
The song is I Enjoy Being a Girl, which, as I mentioned, is from Flower Drum Song. According to the Wikipedia entry on Flower Drum Song, none of the other songs from that musical are at all memorable or interesting. This is the only one that has a separate follow-up link. The Muppet Wikia page about this says that the song is performed multiple times by Muppet Properties and then lists it twice.
I mean, that is multiple times.
Yeah, but they made it sound like it was a bunch of times, and then it appeared once on this and once on Sesame Street. This is a really fun sketch in that once they've changed into their karate geese. And
it took me a minute to realize they were karate geese. I initially thought they were just robes. Mm. And then it was on the second watch. I was like, oh, those are geese. Awesome.
And Cheryl has her dummy. And Piggy has her lovemate punching bag. And then they tear apart the dressing room. And this, to me, is the real fun bit, is that they've come up with the contrast of the lyrics of I Enjoy Being a Girl being like, I like to curl my eyelashes, I like to wear frilly dresses with lace, and they're kicking the crap out of the set.
Lots of falls, lots of hits.
And Kermit's legs as his dummy gets thrown through the air.
Yeah, you know I love just flying legs. lots here. And very fun. Liked it a lot.
The only previous contemporary performance of I Enjoy Being a Girl that's listed on Secondhand Songs is from 1968, when it was performed by Phyllis Diller on her album Born to Sing.
So maybe it's from Sesame Street,
yeah,
but that just rang a bell for me, because I know I've heard this song before. And I don't think I've seen this before. But you saying Phyllis Diller rang something true in my brain and being like, oh yeah, I know that. Don't know if I know it or not.
It does have cultural resonance as one of those things that people would do on Fame. And
yeah, I could see it being in commercials.
Yes.
So maybe I've just heard the song.
In terms of professional recordings, it didn't have nearly as big of a cover impact as other things. In fact, in general, this episode has had weird music choices in terms of popularity, notoriety, or a degree of resonant success. And it makes me wonder, who chose these songs compared to other songs in other episodes in this season? This is a very low-impact, low-key series of choices. And is that because of Cheryl Ladd? Or is that because the musical production team had a crazy off week?
Yeah. I mean, it was the last episode of the season, so maybe they just ran out of budget and really had to go cheap.
That's literally the kind of conclusions I was coming to before I then found out that they didn't hold up to scrutiny in terms of the production dates.
One last thing to cover, because it is how the next segment starts. Mm. The last thing that happens to Kermit is that he gets hit in the face with a pie and falls down. Because the next segment starts backstage, Kermit wiping the pie off his face.
It's a strange angle on backstage. that's accentuated by the fact that the lighting is really weird.
Yeah, it's like a pink-purple hue.
It doesn't feel at all like the backstage atmosphere because the lights. Those lights continue the next time we go backstage, but it's still bizarre. And I don't know if that... I couldn't figure out if that was an attempt at creating, like, spillover light from the stage, or if it was an attempt at creating a vibe for what is established in this shot, which is that Kermit has behind him four hypnotized chickens. And so what the director was trying to go for was an eeriness that came about from the strange, wide-eyed, hypnotized glare of these chickens.
Yeah, that's my best guess. But unlike the last segment, I have no justifications for it.
Once Kermit notices that the chickens are standing there all glassy-eyed and starts to try and shoo them off, Gonzo zooms on stage to say, "Be careful with them. They've been hypnotized. They are completely under my control." Kermit has just used the intercom to call Gonzo to tell him that his hypnosis act is ready, but seems wholly unaware of whatever Gonzo was going to do in his act. It seems like what it was going to be was having something to do with the hypnotized chicken. But once we get on stage, he has props set up for a completely different act.
So here's my justification now.
Yeah, hit me.
Kermit knew he was going to be doing a hypnotism act.
Yep.
Knew that the weight was going to be there. So he wasn't expecting the chickens to be hypnotized, but Gonzo hypnotized the chickens to practice his abilities to make sure he could, in fact, hypnotize things.
Hmm. But Kermit's comment, once he sees Gonzo demonstrate that the chickens are under his control by having them bark like dogs, mm-hmm. is he says, "I'm not even going to introduce you. This is a terrible act."
Yeah, no, that is where my justification ends.
But it's also, Kermit is the worst stage manager.
Oh, yeah.
He literally is going to cancel an act that he booked without knowing what it was going to be.
But it is Gonzo. He tends to do that to Gonzo anyway.
Well, he tends to put Gonzo out there, and then Gonzo's act goes much faster than anticipated because it's going to fail.
Yeah.
But in this case, Kermit's the reason it's going to fail because he decides to get cold feet and no longer allow this miserable Gonzo act to take place. Whereas normally he's let Gonzo do all kinds of dumb decisions.
And so I will push back that this is Kermit actually being a good stage manager, because if all the other times it's gone poorly and he doesn't believe in this one, then yeah, cancel it.
I would say that if Kermit said, "I'm not even going to let you go on stage," and went straight to the intercom to say, "Vet's hospital on next."
Well, that's because he doesn't get that chance, because Gonzo sticks the chickens on him who carry him on stage.
Gonzo's performance here is pretty great in mm-hmm. that Kermit says, "I'm not even going to introduce you for a crummy set like that." And there's the perfect beat between when Kermit says that and then when Gonzo says, "Sick him."
Yeah.
But while dramatically and performance-wise, that's great for Gonzo and by extent Dave, that was all the time in the world that Kermit needed to get to that intercom.
Nah, he's a terrible stage manager. He had to see if Gonzo was going to call his bluff or not. You know, maybe he'll just go away.
But the chickens all attack and they push him out onto stage, at which point we cut to the curtain. And with all the chickens around him, Kermit says, okay, I'll introduce him. And then one of the hypnotized chickens that's been saying bow wow says, meow.
I didn't catch that.
And Kermit looks at him for a second and then carries on by saying, "Here he is, ladies and gentlemen, your own, and you're welcome to him, Gonzo the Great." Not the Great Gonzo.
Mmm. Also missed that.
This episode started off with a refutation of my earlier comment about the fact that women are always introduced as Miss and men are introduced without a title.
Mm-hmm.
And Cheryl was introduced without a Miss.
But in the closing, gets a Miss.
Correct. In the last two times, when she comes out for the number and when they do the curtain call, she gets missed both times. But in her previous...
No, he says it both times. He doesn't miss saying it.
I missed that. She does get that diminutive feminine title back again. Again, I was thinking this was end of the season stuff, And similarly, the transition from the great Gonzo to Gonzo the Great, I figured might have been something that happened over the course of the production. All my wild theories are totally just thrown out the window.
Crumbling around you.
Gonzo comes out and says that he is a master of hypnosis, and for any students of the occult, as he gestures wildly with his arms in a brand new puppeteering technique that we haven't seen Dave do before, he's going to show the power of hypnosis by having a member of the audience put into a trance, and just with the power of suggestion, they'll be able to hold aloft the 5,000-pound weight that the curtains pull back and reveal.
He tells the audience it's just a question of mind over matter. To which Waldorf replies, that's right, you don't mind and we don't matter.
And
that should absolutely be flipped. Because the way Waldorf says it, it's not a burn. It doesn't mean anything. Where if he flipped it and said either, that's right, we don't mind and you don't matter.
Okay.
Or that's right, we don't mind that you don't matter. Both of those are burns that make sense. Saying you don't mind and we don't matter is burning the audience, not the act. So that made me mad.
Yeah. Well, I think it fits with the weird haphazard combo scripting that's been going on in this episode. Because again, this feels like it comes out of nowhere. This should be, according to previous Gonzo arcs, at the beginning of the show so we can deal with the repercussions. But instead, they're stuffing the act and the repercussions into the last 7 minutes of the show.
That I don't mind, because it's basically just a redux of
the cannonball catch act.
Except that Gonzo doesn't have magical healing powers now. So I'm okay with this being,
well, that's because he doesn't have
crammed into the last act.
Doesn't have John Cleese there with his racist understandings of the art of Tao Tu Chinghua.
Yep, that's true.
And we hadn't set up Cheryl Ladd as also being, you know, the Iron Fist and having her white savior Asian powers to be able to fix him after her karate act.
But again, then our complaint would have been they just did this in the John Cleese episode.
Yeah. I mean, a season ago.
Yeah, if I remembered.
Which you may not have done until I brought it up.
I mean, I remembered the fact that there was a Gonzo stretchy thing.
I mentioned it earlier in this episode.
It's also in my notes.
Okay, fair.
However, the guest star was nowhere near. That was something I had no clue or memory of.
Gonzo's also, in response to my criticism in the Alice Cooper episode, where I felt like Gonzo wouldn't have wanted to sign a contract with the devil for fame and fortune because his artistic integrity is too precious, is right back in second season artistic mode here, where he's yelling at the audience. He's not, doesn't call them yokels, but he does say, I don't understand you people. Immortality is in your grasp. And he's fighting against the perception of what he thinks is great entertainment and the fact that nobody's responding to it. This is Gonzo in Gonzo Zone. The Gonzone, if you will.
I like that. I don't necessarily think it's that. I think it's that they don't believe in him because the consequences are a 5,000-pound weight crushes an audience member, and they're not willing to volunteer for that. If it was like, oh, I'll make you say some funny things, or I'll make you cluck like a chicken, I'm sure someone in the audience would have volunteered.
Yeah, but you want to be careful being hypnotized to cluck like a chicken around Gonzo. He might fall in love with you.
Wouldn't that be so bad? But the danger of
the real threat of having been underneath a 5,000-pound weight is preventing everybody from volunteering.
If I was someone who volunteered for stage things, I wouldn't volunteer for this.
Excellent counter-argument. But Statler and Waldorf mentioned that he should do it himself. And he is enthralled with this idea because he will go down in history as somebody who hypnotizes himself. And then we have a great bit where he, out of thin air, produces a hand mirror that allows him to stare into his own eyes and go through the hypnosis patter.
And it also allows them to show off the eye technology mm-hmm. that they've developed over the past three seasons.
Yeah. He then, with a crash of cymbals and percussion, slams into I'm hypnotized mode, walks under the weight, tells them to release the rope that's holding it up. The rope falls for a full 4 seconds.
Hey, Ben. Leads credence to the whole House of Leaves situation.
Talk to me about whether my math here is at all possible. If something falls at 9.8 meters per second, and squared. The rope falls for 4 seconds, it's 10 meters the first second. Does that mean that 10 squared is 100?
Yeah.
So would it be 100 meters the second of rope that falls? 1,000 meters of rope that falls the third second?
No, I think that is where you're getting out, because then you have to apply the air resistance coefficient,
yeah.
and that's based off of the mass of the rope. But so
wouldn't it just be more likely to say that 40 meters of rope yes. fell in 4 seconds?
Yes, that is the easiest, not the most accurate way, but close enough for our purposes.
Well, just to say, 40 meters of stage is still wildly more than any theater needs.
Yep, it's a real, Ben, say it with me now,
House of Leaves situation. So I enjoyed that. I literally was just like, I love the fact that the joke of rope falling for that long confirms our stupid fan theory about how tall the rafters are in this theater.
Now, there is another theory.
Okay.
Or another explanation for that is it may not have been tied only to the top.
Right.
A lot of times they
go up and then back down to a counterweight.
Then that's only 20 feet, which is fairly reasonable. Or 20 meters, which is still
60 feet.
Okay, that's pretty high. Well, no, I'd say, like,
that's two stories.
Yeah, but the House of Leaves situation, that is the Boston Opera House.
Mm-hmm. You think that stage is two stories tall?
I mean, we're on the second balcony very high up. Yeah. It's probably close to that. So I'm going to say that's reasonable if it goes all the way up and then all the way back down.
Yep.
It probably is tied off somewhere in the middle.
To a weight of equal weight, or if not more.
Hey, but I want to support the House of Leaves situation, so I'm going to say it's tied directly up there, and it's 40 meters high.
It's a great special effect. Mm-hmm. You can barely see the fishing line that's holding the weight up after the rope falls down.
Yeah, the only time you can see the fishing line is when the weight drops, and then you see all 40 feet of the fishing line drop, and that gets caught by the light real good.
Because once Gonzo is successful in his hypnosis to have the ability to push the weight up,
mm-hmm.
Sattler cries out, "Very impressive, but how do you get out of it?" Gonzo says, "Oh, simple, I just snap my fingers," wakes himself out of his trance, and then the weight falls down on top of him.
Mm-hmm.
But Pete,
yeah,
I have some disastrous Taskmaster-esque, you screwed up the task rules in this follow-up.
Yeah.
Because once the 5,000 pounds of weight fall on Gonzo,
mm-hmm.
what is he able to do?
Lift it up so he can
get out from underneath it. Which means he either isn't fully unhypnotized or it never weighed that much to begin with.
I mean, he only lifted it a couple of inches up.
Regardless, you don't... The ability to lift 5,000 pounds is still the ability to lift 5,000 pounds, whether you're keeping it from falling on you from a height of 4.5 feet, or whether you're lifting it from a dead drop up 6 inches so you can get out from underneath it.
That could have been adrenaline, mother lifting car off baby energy of, I'm under this, I need to get out from
it. Those famous 5,000 pound cars.
Cars are very heavy.
Cars are very rarely 2.5 tons.
Cars are very heavy, Ben.
Even when you put enough armor plating on a car that you can't shoot through it with a bow and arrow, it rarely wears 2.5 tons.
In the 70s when they were made out of steel? Now, all plastic cars? Sure, I believe you.
Buick classic 1976 Ford F-100.
A Buick LeSabre 1978 with wood paneling. Wood paneling?
Wood. Twice as dense as metal.
Also, the weight falling counts as a fall. We're up to 4.
Okay. Statler and Waldorf then immediately comment on, Gonzo's attempt at trying to reclaim this, saying, hey, Kermit, it was terrific, by saying, well, he thinks it's terrific, but I bet I know how he really feels.
Statler wants to know how that is.
And Waldorf says, about so high.
And then Statler repeats it. I didn't love that.
It is traditional, I'm laughing at the joke my friend just said, yeah. Behavior.
But they don't usually do that. They go, they just laugh.
Yeah. He even says it over the cut to backstage.
Yeah.
Like, it's a sound edit that they decided to keep in.
And as you said, we cut backstage where Kermit hesitantly tells Gonzo while looking down at him because he's so small. That was a nice one.
The lighting is still weird in this, the final backstage segment. They've kept whatever strange decision they've done. So it no longer feels like it's about the hypnosis of the chickens and just feels like they did a terrible job lighting the backstage set for whatever day they were filming this on.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that this is now the second runner after the established abandoned runner of the other thing makes it feel like they just did this at a completely different time and wedged it in. But it has to match up because of the next segment where it comes back into the Cheryl Ladd bit.
Yep. So maybe the wedged segment was the Fozzie segment.
Could have been.
Because there's no reference to Beethoven or Ralph or Fozzie anywhere else in the episode. So, yeah, that could have been the post-break reason why this became episode 24.
Hmm.
Yes, we got a wild speculation theory to justify. We're running out of time. Kermit asks Gonzo how he finds these acts, and that's why Gonzo still needs to be small, because he says he keeps his ear to the ground.
And Kermit looks directly at the audience and says, it looks like it, the second end of a sketch in a row where they had a completely unnecessary button.
Mm-hmm. Kermit introduces the final act.
Again, as we mentioned, he starts off by talking about Gonzo, which makes it feel embedded in the continuity of the episode.
Mm-hmm.
Says, you'll all be happy to know that Gonzo survived and is looking forward to his new career as a lump. Some of the worst writing that the show has ever exhibited. Which makes me think maybe they were glad to abandon some of this and wedge in the other stuff. This has a callback to the backstage voice that Frank Oz occasionally does, where Kermit will talk to a mystery stagehand to ask whether everything's all set, and Frank does a really low voice. I've mentioned before that this lends credence to our fan theory that follows up from the aforementioned John Cleese episode, where they stuff him into things, and so therefore they have the ability to just rush stuff on and get it ready.
Despite Kermit being the worst stage manager in the world, they have the best stage crew in the world.
Here's a weird thing that the DVDs say.
Yeah.
In the subtitles, when the voice talks, it says, open brackets, pig, close brackets.
Interesting.
The fandom page just refers to this offstage voice as stagehand.
Yeah.
It doesn't identify it in any way more than that for this episode. I didn't go back and find other episodes where it's listed, but this to me feels like Frank doing a monster voice. The DVDs apparently think this is Frank doing a pig voice.
In my notes, I wrote a monster-sounding Muppet. Ask Who Wants to Know.
Yep.
So
very weird, out-of-left-field DVD interpretation of what's going on. We then have the wonderful Miss Cheryl Ladd introduced, and we have the only vaguely contemporary song on the soundtrack to this episode, Sunshine, perhaps more commonly known as Sunshine on My Shoulders, which is a John Denver song, which originally appeared on his 1971 album Poems, Prayers, and Promises, and was released as a single in 1973. John Denver is going to be the first production episode of season 4, and that will film in April of 1979. In June of 1979, Denver will go into the studio to record the relatively well-beloved John Denver and the Muppets A Christmas Together album, which will come out seasonally appropriate. John 316.
Mm.
Will take place approximately 1 year after this episode was recorded, which was in May of 78. June 76 is when Jim Nabors' production was when they did the John Denver song, Thank God I'm a Country Boy, which seems to be the earliest appearance of Denver in Muppet production at all. So within 3 years of Jim Nabors doing a John Denver song, John Denver was cutting an entire album with the Muppets.
I mean, Denver is 5,280 feet high, so he didn't have to go far to reach the heights of Muppet fame.
Well, sunshine nearly always makes me high.
It's true.
But not Rocky Mountain high.
No. Colorado.
Those are the Rockies.
That was the next lyric to the song.
Oh. Well, take us home, Country Roads. Let's get back on track. The very pastel set. Her outfit is a red and white striped blouse with a blue and white striped vest with a yellow and white striped collar, and she's wearing a pink and white striped skirt. But because of the white stripes in them, and not the
Jack
band,
and Meg,
yeah, in the fabric, when you pan back on television, it just blurs into a very faint pastel color. Up close, you can see the stripes. But in the back, it just helps make them incredibly pale, which combined with the pale blue fence post, the early spring blossom flowers that they're using, and some of the brightest lights they've used in Muppet sketch history, just gives this an extraordinary vibe that feels different than pretty much everything we've seen on the Muppet Show so far. The song is therefore pretty but innocuous.
Yep.
And then the strange thing that happens is during the second verse, they zoom out to show all of the animals from Stop Children, What's That Sound in the foreground. And then behind the pale blue fence that Cheryl Ladd is standing at, Fozzie comes on with a dazed, worshipful expression, and then Scooter follows suit, and then a clutch of other all-male Muppets.
Yeah, Rolf pops up over from behind her shoulder.
And then Robin and Kermit and Beauregard and two of the mammals from the foreground.
Should have been George.
All also. But seriously, Scooter and Fozzie's expressions of worshipful awe before they all start singing along with her in the last verse is legitimately on the edge of creepy.
I mean, maybe Gonzo hypnotized them, so they're just still in the days.
It's the final triptych of Cheryl Ladd talking about undressing, Cheryl Ladd actually undressing, and now a bunch of male Muppets staring at her like they're undressing her with their eyes over the course of this sketch.
Also leading to that kind of weird theory is at the very end of the song, everyone looks directly down the barrel of the camera in like a weird cult-like thing, like, join us. But I didn't count that as looking down the barrel because it didn't break a fourth wall. It was, that was natural camera looking.
The fact that even Cheryl does it did make it strange. I also didn't count it when I was doing my own tally, but I did think about it. It's like, yeah, that's odd.
But doesn't qualify in my general nebulous rules.
And then, again, one of my wild speculations that I can no longer draw conclusions to because it's not at the end of the season. Instead of going to the curtain, we cut back from the ad break to being in this exact same set with everybody standing in the same location.
And I liked that because they were all already there, so might as well use it. I thought that was very creative.
I like it as a technique, but I liked it more as something they would have evolved to, as opposed to it just randomly happening. And then this episode also ends with a button joke about Gonzo still being squished.
Mm-hmm.
And then them laughing like it's the end of a G.I. Joe cartoon. They're all standing there going, oh, chortling together. Much in the way that the Statler and Waldorf are supposed to, instead of Statler repeating Waldorf's joke. Like, the vibe on the final awful fake laugh in this episode is so bizarre.
Now, maybe your theory about this being a progression of something that they grow into could still be true.
This could be the start.
Yeah, it's just that the episode isn't the 24th.
And therefore they're not good at it yet.
Yeah, so going forward we might see more of this happening.
And it might be smoother and more naturalistic.
Or still just as choppy.
Well, one could only hope it gets better, because this was a real low point.
Oh, well, I thought I was talking about the transition to this being...
As opposed to the hearty chuckle at the final moment.
Yeah, that I hope goes away. But the transition, I hope, stays. We get the credits. Statler and Waldorf come back.
And Waldorf says, well, let's go while the going's good.
And Statler says, well, I'm glad something's good tonight.
Because that fake laughter and some of the writing and most of the music was all not.
Don't know what you're talking about with most of the music. One of the best songs I've ever heard was in this episode. And I had to take the plastic wrap off of a DVD to hear it. Well, now that we're done with the episode, let's talk about some statistics. There was 13.89 minutes of music out of 25.67 minutes of show for 54.11% music.
Which feel is like we've been being over 50% pretty consistently recently.
We're 50-50. Four episodes above, four episodes below.
That's statistically normal.
Yeah. There were 10 hits this episode, no explosions, four falls, no kisses.
And how many takes to camera did you think there were?
Three.
I got eight.
Yeah, that's a big difference.
Yeah, it is.
I will also say, still pretty bad at catching those.
All right, then you might as well go with my number because I can back up all of mine.
And since we agreed on the last one wasn't. All right. Yep. As for my enjoyment of Cheryl Ladd, I put her at seventh.
Wow. I expected a little lower than that because while she was good at what she did, she didn't strike me as memorable, especially. And so I figured you would place her solidly in the middle.
I really enjoyed the
dressing room sketch.
The dressing room sketch and the jazz number. I thought she did a really good job. And Sunshine on My Shoulders, she sang really well.
Yeah.
It was a classic boring sketch, but she was enthralling enough to enthrall all of the Muppets. And I think I will remember her dancing.
Oh, interesting.
I won't remember that song, you're right. But I'll remember, oh, she was a really good dancer.
Yeah.
So yeah, enjoyable.
I agree.
And also, I think she won a lot of points with me having, I mean, granted, I have no expectations from most of these people who I don't know who they are. But I really had no expectations of who she was as a person other than Charlie's Angels. So everything that she did well, I was like, oh, she's really good. So I probably gave her some bonus points, but there's room for adjustments.
Yeah, we got a whole...
We got
two-thirds of the episode to slot in someplace, so...
Yep.
Speaking of the fact that this is a third of the way into the season...
Good call. We have to go over quiz. Well, Ben, going into today, I was up 4 points to two. And then you destroyed this quiz and got 4 points. So for the second four-episode streak in a row, you won 6-4. So congratulations, Ben. You get another minifig.
For today's minifig, we're going to see what we get from the misophonic rapper.
Put it closer. Really drive these people wild.
This segment's minifig is...
Is it a repeat?
Fozzie Bear!
Ooh! Not a repeat, and a main player.
His mouth is in a good waka 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 position.
Yep, very cool.
Ah! Fozzie comes with a microphone on a stand.
Cool.
And a banana.
A solid banana, not a peeled banana.
Correct.
It would be great if you could peel that banana and then have a banana peel as another prop.
That would be appealing.
I gotta go.
As always, we like to end each episode by talking about our favorite moments of the episode in order to highlight some of not just the sketches, but the performance and production notes that we think are worthy of extra mention. I'm going to start us off this week by talking about Link in the True Love sketch. I talked a lot about what Piggy was wearing, and we talked about the fact that they're clearly doing a Tarzan riff.
Mm-hmm.
But I wanted to point out an aspect of Link's costume, which is while he's swinging on a vine and he's wearing a Tarzan tiger-striped print, he's also wearing a long-sleeved gray shirt under his tiger print but above his skin. That is a thing that is absolutely rooted in classic Hollywood. The scoop of the gray shirt is low enough that you get a tuft of blonde hair on his chest, but he's still like, I'm macho, I'm amazing, I'm Link and I'm great, but also I want to hide my body. And it's never commented upon, it's just what they've decided to do with the production, and it helps them in their own conception, I'm assuming, of who Link is, and I enjoyed picking up on the weirdness of it.
See, I thought you were going to talk about something else. A moment I thought I wasn't going to have to talk about because you were about to take it, which was the puppeteering of Link while he was swinging on the vine.
It's so good.
Yeah. I was like, oh, they're doing more cool stuff that you would never see in normal puppeteering.
Yep. And I did think about that as a moment. It was definitely on my short list of options because for Jim to be puppeteering Link while he swings across on the vine, basically assuming that Jim is running underneath back and forth on the set,
yeah,
and they've got careful camera movement in order to, depending on where he is on the arc, pan up a little bit so that he can come up out of the ground and be still invisible. It was all very well done.
Yeah.
But I thought that this part was weirder and more interesting.
Well, that was a cheap way for me to not talk about a moment. Because for my first moment, our second moment, I'm going to keep moving...
Right along
with this episode.
Footloose and fancy free.
Talking about the first backstage segment.
Okay.
Now, we often don't give Frank Oz enough credit on this show.
Yeah, because we've taken to heart the fact that Jerry is the secret star of the show,
uh-huh,
and most of our moments are Jerry-focused,
right,
and we just don't give enough shrift to the other Muppet performers.
And also, Richard Schiff is not in the Muppets. But in that first backstage segment, I love when Frank underplays things.
Mm.
And when Fozzie enters, he acknowledges Beethoven with just a simple, hi. And I loved it. It got me so good.
Kermit, excuse me. Hi. Kermit, excuse me, but are you busy?
While I'm doing that introduction for sure, I'll land.
Good.
I even wrote it in my notes as lowercase hi, period. It's so flat. It's so nonchalant. It's not... I mean, granted, Beethoven, the bust of Beethoven has been around before.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it wouldn't be a surprise to see a talking statue. But it's just like, oh, this is polite.
I actually more appreciated, along a similar vein, he comes in, both in the first and second segments, he says, excuse me to Kermit, then realizes he hasn't excused himself to Beethoven, and then says it to him. Fozzie is a very polite boy.
Well, he's working on self-improvement.
That's true. But also in general, we've acknowledged the way in which he goes into deference mode,
mm-hmm,
around Kermit. And this is one of the ways in which that comes out. Fozzie throwing that away, but still making sure that he checks all the right boxes of Miss Manners would approve of this.
Mm-hmm.
Is my sideways not third moment? Piggybacking on you.
No, I talked about Fozzie, not Miss Piggy.
Okay. Fozzie backing on you.
There we go.
But for my third moment, my second moment, our third moment, I want to go back to how much I enjoyed Gonzo's return to form in the hypnotism segment.
But Ben, we already talked about he doesn't return to form. He stays small. unlike in the John Cleese episode where he does have the ability to return to form.
But prior to losing his form in the first place.
Right. Okay. Now I'm with you.
He is, in my opinion, keeping with the vibe that Gonzo has established in previous seasons, where I feel like the writers of third season might not quite have gotten that.
Mm-hmm.
But when he walks out on stage and his theme music plays, classic early season Gonzo behavior takes place in that only one person claps
yep.
for Gonzo the Great. And I can't begin to tell you how happy that made me. There's something about that fanfare and the desultory, lonely clap that to me is the soundtrack that all great Gonzo stuff must start with. If it has too much enthusiasm, I'm already off. It's like being no longer invested in a band because they've gone mainstream.
Disney Plus captioned it as sparse applause.
DVD captions was single person applause.
Gonzo the Great!
Thank you! Thank you!
Yeah, it was great. I made a note of it in my notes, and when we breezed right past it, I went, all right, that's going to be a moment for one of us. It's often a way I can kind of gauge what moments are, is if I have notes on it and you skim right past it, I'm like, oh, Ben Saban in that one. Because I do the same thing.
Yes, you do. Yeah, each of us is in a kind of Tai Chi balance of noticing what the other person might be saving for the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm. And then when we re-bring up something, it's because we don't have very many other moments to talk about. But yeah, that was a great moment, and I also, yeah.
But it's kind of a cheat because it has happened a lot.
Yeah.
But because it's been a while since it happened.
Yeah, and we just had the whole lead up to it of Kermit breaking him down.
Yeah.
So then if the audience was enthusiastic, that wouldn't make sense tonally either. It has to be sparse applause, and it should be sparse applause. So that way we can scream to the rafters how great Gonzo is.
Those rafters are really high up.
Oh, yeah, at least 40 meters. For my second moment, our fourth moment, my final moment, we talked about how terrible that trumpet player was in South Rampart Street Parade. But I want to talk about how great the drummer was.
Mm.
The drummer Muppet had, it was one of those big bass drums with just a cymbal on top. And that drummer was just having a ball, just slapping the drum and then slapping the cymbal alternatively. And it wasn't on time at all. It didn't match with the music. Only a couple of times did it match where like the music had two cymbal crashes and they do two cymbal crashes. Otherwise, that Muppet was just
flailing
and with so much energy. And I loved as much credit as I gave to Cheryl for her dancing abilities, it was a struggle sometimes to not have my attention focus stolen by the drummer Muppet. The times where Timmy Monster was blocking the drummer were the times where I was able to really focus on Cheryl.
Which is funny because I was just going to bring up the fact that one of the weirdnesses of that sketch is that there were times in which Timmy Monster was wholly obscuring Cheryl.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we talked about how good the choreography was and how good the energy was, and yet, weirdly enough, the dancing was so strange sometimes, and the camera work was so strange about the dancing, that you sometimes couldn't see the dancer. But I like the fact that one of your favorite parts of that dance was when one of the two dancers was hiding your secret favorite part of the sketch so you could concentrate on the guest star.
It's those stupid big bug eyes with a big yellow nose and their stupid little stomping feet, and then just the energy that that drummer had, just slap, smash, slap, smash. I loved it so much.
Slap, smash, slap, smash. That's the limited edition Comedy Bang Bang vinyl, right?
Oh, yeah. I'd buy that, too. Again, for the sixth time.
Well, now that you say that you were thinking that you might do the single person claps bit from Gonzo. I'm a little disappointed I didn't let you have it, but glad that you had the ability to talk about the left drummer, because
Katy Perry
clearly
left,
got
left drummer.
So much joy out of it. But it does mean I'm going to go back to Gonzo for my third moment, our fifth moment, the final moment of this episode. Because
I really thought you were going to talk about Worms, the best song that's ever been on The Muppet Show. But I guess I'm wrong. And you're going back to Gonzo. It's fine.
Yeah, well, in general, we like our moments to be positive things that happened in the episode. Whereas there was not only nothing positive in the Worms segment.
Best song of all time.
The fact that Disney has removed it and kept it removed like it should have always been removed from American programming is the best thing the Walt Disney Corporation has ever done, and they rarely do good things.
So what you're saying is your favorite moment of the show is the Disney Plus cut version of this episode.
But also, I got so distracted by the accidental shadows of the Muppeteers in the background. I spent so much time just watching because I didn't have to concentrate on the lyrics because I knew them after the first 13 seconds of the song.
Hey, Ben, unlike South Rampart Street Parade, you'll never forget these lyrics.
I will gladly forget these lyrics. If I have to go to the Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind in order to remove them, I will pay for that technique.
Sure, which will work until you're like, what's that new sound? And you're like, oh, Worms. It's made by Worms. Sorry, I got you off track.
Constantly looking at the shadows of the Muppeteers and the Worms in the background of the shot in the wall. Just watching and watching and watching and be like, I can't believe they lit this so badly that they couldn't hide the fact that while we're not supposed to be watching that, we're supposed to be waiting for the Worms to come back out. All I can do is see the shadows of arms in the various little caverns in the back.
Perfect sketch.
Terrible sketch. What is a perfect sketch is Gonzo and the 5,000 pound weight. So much so that I could have done all five moments from it. But instead, I'm restraining myself and just doing two. And the second bit I want to talk about is the strange dangling thread of Gonzo's ego, which is revealed in a single word of dialogue. Once he comes out and he introduces the concept and reveals the weight, he then says the following: who will be the first lucky volunteer? He's going to do this a bunch of times. It's going to go so well that there's going to be a chain of people who want to participate in this.
Yeah, I never thought about that.
That's why he's so astonished by the fact that no one will do it and shouts out, what's wrong with you people? He expected a line. And that's what that one word reveals. Such good writing. The fact that they include that in there to give us a worldview of his expectations for the moment versus what actually happens.
Yeah, and instead, the weight of the world came crashing down upon him. And apparently the world only weighs 5,000 pounds.
Well, it's only 6,000 years old.
Yeah, and it's flat.
That's right. So it can't accumulate that much mass.
No. If a turtle can carry it.
That's right.
Anything more than that would crush a turtle's shell.
Yeah. I mean, not a hero in a half shell.
No, turtle power. This episode of The Henson Perspective was researched, performed, and edited by Ben Russell and Pete Russell. Sound design, such as it is, also by the two of us.
Our logo is based on designs by Liana Amler. Thank you, Liana. Music in the episode comes from archive.org and archival Henson Associate clips of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, under what we hope is transformative fair use, much as the Hensons did when they first broadcast terrible worm songs to Salmon Friends.
You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Blue Sky at Farce Name Basis. This podcast, as conceived of by Nathan Emily and Ben Russell, is an intellectual exploration of the great power of worms.
All excerpts in the podcast are used for the purposes of review. If there are things, dates, facts, names, takes to camera, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website and we'll post it to our errata page on farceperspective.com as soon as possible.
Again, our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation about worms. I'm Pete, my co-host is Ben.
Meow.
And we'll see you next time when we discuss Season 3, Production Episode 5, guest starring Pearl Bailey. Worms!
Fired. You're fired.
You brought that all upon yourself.